You sound so giddy and excited.
Well, it is, of course, a joyous occasion.
It's been so long since we talked last that so much has changed in my life that I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Between the actual conversations and then the internet text conversations, it's been like minutes.
Well, like minutes. If minutes were like hours, Dan, then it would take days.
If minutes were like hours, we could appropriately quantify how long we've been doing this podcast, which is what we're doing today. Hooray!
Yes. And some of our feedback was about Star Trek references, which is what I just made. So I am very happy that that flew right over your radar.
Absolutely. Completely over my head. I had no idea what the hell you were talking about.
Yay.
I mean, I guess it worked to make you sound sort of like fancy and philosophical.
Not really, because it was just a quote from the thing. But anyway, we should go into things, I guess. Is there anything you would like to do to celebrate our year's worth of recording from our initial inception?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. We took questions. We'll answer questions. I don't know. I don't really have any other business other than the questions. Did you have anything saved up that you were looking forward to doing on this show?
No, I just thought you were going to have like some prepared opening statements to lead us in. Some like walk down memory lane.
I have had the time of my life. Wait, I think I might be scripting that from somewhere.
You didn't deliver that with the appropriate level of enthusiasm. I'm having the time of my life.
I didn't do it quite with the same staccato nature that was in the song. I couldn't bring myself to do that.
Okay.
yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, the year has, well, it hasn't flown by, but it seems to have gone quickly.
Yeah. Well, time flies when you're having fun.
Sure.
And what have we been doing other than having fun?
Working. There's that.
Yes.
It's interesting how much things have changed from the beginning there when we were both sort of just unemployed and aimlessly wandering around and looking for something to do, because the podcast kind of spawned out of boredom, I guess, to a certain extent, because neither of us were really doing anything, and then Skype.
Yes. Well, I mean, it predated that. We had talked for a long time on Twitter about a year before we even started the podcast, and we'd come to know one another through being mutual followers of Merlin Man and having said things to one another off of tweets on things and stuff. And so we came to interact with one another. And then we... So I guess you could say we were podcast groupies. And then we...
Part of the Merlin Mutual Admiration Society?
I guess.
You make it sound like we were in a fan club or something, and we just both showed up to the same like meeting.
Well, I was thinking more of a cult, really. Like
the dress cult code. Of Merlin.
Yes.
There's a dress code.
There has to be. I mean, you can't follow someone like that and not have a dress code.
I'm not wearing shoes though.
And so the thing
was it really about a year's worth of Twitter interaction before the show?
I think it was, or at least it was. I think the first tweet that I exchanged with you was in 2012 at some point. And
I feel like I should have looked this up for historical purposes.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. but it was like end of the year 2012. And so then we talked through 2013, the Halcyon days. And early 2014, we were getting off to this start of like maybe we could podcast. How hard could it be? It's just Skype, right?
Sure.
Yeah,
it's just a phone call with somebody you've never met over the internet.
Yeah, total instant chemistry and conversation, and everything works.
Especially when you get really drunk ahead of time.
Oh God, that was okay. Another thing about the show's mythology: there are several unreleased episodes of this show where we weren't sure what we were doing in any sense of the word. Sure. So we just kind of were throwing things against the wall to see what would stick and like trying different things out. And we were like, oh, maybe it'd be kind of funny if we like had a couple drinks and then podcasted. No.
Yeah, we'll be nice and loose and relaxed, and, you know, we'll just let the conversation flow. And it didn't flow. It was a lot of ranting and then some very long periods of silence while the other person gathered themselves and then ranted about something.
Yes. So no, there's a reason why they're unreleased episodes.
And we also, weren't even talking about movies back then, were we? What was the topic of conversation?
It wasn't even usually any topic. It was just like whatever was irking you in your life. And then conversely, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that sucks. It kind of sounds like this other story from my life. It was not interesting.
All Florida and Arizona, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was mostly about Florida and mostly about Arizona. You kept the Arizona brand intact. Let's be honest. That carried through to the show. That worked well in the pilot. But yeah, so there are some unreleased episodes, and we weren't even sure like it was going to be a movie podcast, like you're saying, or that it would relate to what we do in our jobs. Because I remember also having a fear of it being traced back to me and being summoned into like HR to answer for my sins or something.
How dare you have opinions about movies?
Yeah, I know. Because in theory, you know, if some client somewhere were to go and like look up, who somebody having some ranty opinion, like if that ever were to be a thing, or to like see if whether or not I should be hired for something, or whether or not you should be hired for something, and they stumble across like this whole thing about, oh, we hate Marvel movies, then, you know, that might affect things for us.
Addendum, we don't hate Marvel movies, and just they all haven't been that good.
That's and, a good qualifier.
Sure. Actually, I was tempted to go off on a Guardians of the Galaxy rant, but I won't because careers or something. I think we've successfully been able to express ourselves while simultaneously protecting our potential interests. We've done a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Protecting our brand.
Protecting our brand. No, I meant more of our personal interests.
Mm-hmm. I feel protected.
I feel very protected. Well, actually, you know what? Maybe this show is the reason why I don't have much work these days. I should come up with some sort of conspiracy theory that I could use to justify my employment.
Yes, because that's how it works. But the other part of this was also back when we didn't know what it was going to be. Was also we might have also had a third host on, and then we weren't sure what to do with that, and things fell through with scheduling and timing, and then we just moved ahead and did something else anyways, because like I said, we didn't even know it was gonna be movies for like three more times.
Right. And of course we were antsy and unemployed, so it was just like, hey, fire up Skype, let's try it, see how it goes. It wasn't the first time we actually did it like 1 in the morning or some crap, or it was like 11 p.m. It was just like, yeah, why not? I'm not in the mood to go to bed yet. Let's just turn on the Skype.
Yeah, I think it was one. I'm not sure how it worked exactly, if you drunk dialed me or if I drunk dialed you. But it wasn't good. It was just like a late night board call, and it didn't go anywhere. And as such, I think should be deleted. The other conversations that we had were also suitably unproductive. The first episode of the show was like the seventh or eighth or ninth thing that we recorded. And that was, we just happened to have a set of topics that we were mostly adhering to, about movies. And then through the magic of editing, several sections that didn't work and had nothing to do with movies were removed. And then all of a sudden it looked like we had something that was sort of a podcast, like in the shape of a podcast, like a podcast loaf. It wasn't like a fully formed, delicious confection or anything. It was just sort of like, hey, it's a pile of sugar and water. It's kind of like candy, right? So we worked on that iteratively over the course of, I would say, the next four episodes. And then I think the basic formula of the show developed around our fourth episode.
I remember when we were talking about two movies at the same time per episode?
Yeah, that didn't work. Initially, okay, first of all, that first episode, neither of us... one thing the audience might not understand. Dan and I don't always agree. And don't...
This is shocking news.
I know. Everyone's just gobsmacked. They're clutching their pearls. But the we don't always agree, and we also don't like the same things necessarily. So our film background is different for, like, references that we would make or things we have seen. So nowhere is that more clear than in episode one, where one of us brings up something about a director or something, and then the other one shoots it down and says we haven't seen it. And that goes back and forth. And it became clear, I think, after that, that, you know, two people talking about how they don't know things and sort of speculating about why someone else might like it is probably not a good thing to do for a year. So we didn't do that for a year.
You're saying this is the genesis of why we decided to actually pick a movie ahead of time and watch it, so we made sure we had something to talk about.
Yeah, but then when we picked movies ahead of time, at first decided that, like, one of us would pick one movie and make the other one watch it, and the other one would pick one movie and make the other one watch it. That didn't work, because that's a lot of watching. And also, we had to talk about them coherently. the doubling up on things didn't super work out very well. And it was actually the episodes where we only had one thing to talk about where it wound up working out perfectly. It was almost like we had also talked about, like, how it was sort of like a DVD box set or something where you get, like, two weird movies that kind of don't go together but kind of go together, like Can't Hardly Wait and Dune. And so
we didn't do those in the same episode, did we?
Yes, we did.
We did Can't Hardly Wait and Dune at the same time?
Yes.
What is wrong with us?
You don't even remember your own show, Dan?
I thought Can't Hardly Wait was either by itself or with something else of a similar time. What did we do with Detention?
Oh, that was like episode 9.
Empire Records, wasn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, it was episode 3, Toto's Hey Now, You're an All-Star. that was, if you can't tell by the title.
Wow.
Both of those movies.
Wow. Yeah. That was a weird idea. I'm kind of glad we don't do that anymore.
Yeah. And then I was so...
particularly because we were, like, sprinting through the summation of each movie.
Well, also, you didn't watch all of Dune.
One time, like, that was episode 3, and you're still giving me crap about that? I didn't have enough time. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, we literally stopped recording, and then we started recording again the next day. But anyway, that was the basic formula for the show. And we decided, of course, that one movie to talk about, or one subject to talk about, works out better. And we also have, like, a sort of structure where it winds up being mostly nonsense at the beginning of the show. Some news, some, like, bites about each other's lives, some little ribbing back and forth, perhaps, follow-up, if we happen to have any. And then we go into whatever the movie is, talk about that, and then we conclude with more riffing and nonsense until we can't say anything anymore and just sort of awkwardly try to, like, end on a joke but don't have anything at the ready, and then it just becomes sort of like a very lame, like, thing where we're trying to just, like, end with like a one-liner, and it always kind of, like, fizzles. So I hope the audience has enjoyed that fizzling process at the end of every episode.
Just kind of melts into a pile of awkward silence, and then we cut out most of the awkward silence and make it, like, a slightly less awkward ending, but still awkward.
Yeah, and it usually winds up where we say, like, a few times that we're ending the show, and then at the end of it, we're like, did we really end? We're going to stop the recording? We're going to stop the recording? Yeah, we'll stop the recording. So that gives you some idea of the rigid structure we adhere to, and the quality that we hold ourselves to reproducing every week.
Well, when you're shooting video, it's always good to roll on rehearsal and, like, don't cut too soon, because you never know when those magical moments might occur, which is why we refuse to end the show until we literally have nothing to say, and then try to pull some gems out of that. But there's usually nothing after the first or maybe second ending.
Yeah. Also, it's kind of like a, I guess you could look at it too as this, like, shooting for coverage, and that maybe in the editing bay we can tease something out of the end of that. can like stitch a couple plates together.
By the time we're at the end of like an hour, 45 minute edit session, and we've said, all right, that's the end and it's usable, and there's still like 6 minutes left, I'm like, yeah, it's a usable end. I don't even need to listen to this last 6 minutes. Just delete.
Yeah, well. I mean, what are you going to do? It's not all going to be gold. But that's basically what we've done. And we also have tried not to watch too many new movies that are in the box office that people might not have seen. We try not to watch too many things that aren't available on streaming services in North America. We can't appease the world, though. So, you know, if it's not available in Australia or anywhere else, then I'm sorry, but there's literally no unified streaming service for the planet Earth. So that's the best we can come up with for our movie podcast.
Until Apple gets it all sorted out. Hey, oh, there's some follow up. We'll not do that now.
Yeah, I don't think that's gonna. I don't think that's gonna fly. Yep. And then we have, of course, had our year in review episode, which was for the calendar year, which wound up being sort of a quasi fake award show where we were just trying to do something fun and wacky. And that capped off our themed month of Christmas, where we were watching holiday movies. Which worked out pretty well. And then we didn't really regroup on the theme so much in January. We tried to do like snow and stuff, but I think Snowpiercer crushed our will to live. And then we just needed like something happy after that one. Yeah.
That was a rough episode, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you wanna jump into some questions here? Some of our Q&As, our defocus your faves, et cetera.
I suppose we can get right into it. Yeah, we got a fair amount of questions. Some of them sarcastic, some of them genuinely thought-provoking. But we'll go in order. What do you say about that?
I say that's fine, and I'm mostly shocked that anyone would send anything sarcastic into the show.
it's on brand, so it works. Twitter user master_Dez asked if we take notes while watching a movie or if we just have good memories. And I don't know. Do you take notes? I certainly do. I fill up field notes with as many pages as I feel is appropriate.
It varies depending on the movie. There are some times, especially early on, where I was taking copious notes about everything I was watching. And that usually involved firing up Byword and then just typing and then hitting return a couple times and typing some more, return a couple times. So it was a very loose, not even like an outline structure. And then it would be for anything that was sort of noteworthy that I wanted to come back to. And I would have it up on my monitor and just fling through it while we were talking about things. As we've done more episodes, I find the need to write things down lessons. I wind up sort of absorbing most of whatever it is that we need to talk about. Although there are a few times where I will trip up over the sequence that something occurred in, the chronology of it, which would be helped by notes. But it's, I don't know, it's not always necessary. And it can kind of be a downer if you're trying to like stay engaged with whatever it is that you're watching.
To be definitely a distraction.
Scribbling stuff down. Yeah. And when I watched Avengers, I think was the last time I took notes for anything, the Age of Ultron. And that was in a theater, of course. And just like with Interstellar, which I also took notes for, I had a little pad of paper and a pen, and I was just writing in the dark. When you come out of the theater after that and then you see what you wrote, it's not always very good, but you can usually pull out like a couple of key points that you might not remember after watching a 2.5 hour, 3 hour movie experience about things that bore you. So it's important to take notes in those cases. You can't like rush back into the theater to go check it or fire up Netflix and then scroll backward or anything.
You should have told me. I have a lovely pen that I received from the wonderful folks over at Isilon who make clustered storage. Very expensive clustered storage, but it has a little blue LED at the bottom there that might help you when you're writing in the dark.
No, I think I'm fine.
But it says Isilon on it. It's a very important pen.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be a bad moviegoer and draw attention to myself.
Like that girl in High Fidelity. She had the flashlight pen.
Yes. Well, that wasn't a flashlight pen, was it? I thought it was she had a flashlight and a pen.
No, I think it was part of the pen.
Okay. Yeah, so I don't want to do that. But yeah, that, everything that pretty much answers Master Dez's questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to take, I think I even mentioned in a couple episodes, like 100 different lines of notes in various text editors. I stopped doing digital notes because staring at them on screen is very distracting. But I write down small bullet points in my little field notes there. I rarely refer to them, but it's just to sort of like make sure the movie sticks in my memory as I'm watching it. But I do enjoy taking notes, and yeah, I always get the field notes handy, so why not? Moving along.
Oh, wait. What pen do you use when you're writing your field notes?
I use my fancy Karas Customs billet aluminum pen that I like so much.
You pen addict, you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
it's a very pretty pen.
Uh-huh, I'm sure it is.
And it would come in very handy if I was ever attacked by a French assassin in high school.
Well, you'd be wasting a pen.
it would probably wash off.
Okay, so David, last name withheld.
We always get this wrong. I swear we got it right once, but Fuchs?
I think
F-U-C-H-S?
It is.
F-U-C-H-S?
I think it is Fuchs. It is,
sorry,
it
David.
Yeah, F-U-C-H-S. There are other ways to pronounce that I'm sure he's probably heard under other conditions that he's very unhappy about. And I will not do that. Because I'm a nice guy. So, Fuchs. What are Dan and Joe's picks for the film they consider incredibly bad, but they still enjoy unironically? So, like a guilty pleasure, I guess.
This is a tough one for a number of reasons, because there are so many. And most of them I don't want to admit publicly, but there are a handful of like terrible romantic comedies that generally star like Matthew McConaughey or Hugh Grant that are make me laugh on a couple of levels, partly because of when I saw them, but they still make me laugh just in general. Like God, I guess 2 weeks' notice. Have I brought that up? I that movie makes me laugh way more than it should. Sandra Bullock, Hugh Grant.
I think you might have mentioned it once. Oh, yeah. I still haven't seen it.
That's not surprising. You don't need to go out of your way for it. And you know, there's all of those terrible movies, like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days is a terrible movie, which is also funny.
27 Dresses is one I would throw into the ring.
See, that one's more recent than, even though it's been on TV, I haven't actually seen the whole thing.
Oh, you really should. It's not that good. yeah.
Where does The Proposal land? Because that's another one that's funny, and I don't think you can call it a good movie.
I never saw The Proposal.
Oh, God, you're killing me here. Alaska. Well, not Alaska. It's CG Alaska, but...
Oh, wait. Yes. With Ryan Reynolds and Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Okay. I got that confused with something else. No, I like The Proposal. And yeah, I would agree that's not a well-made film. Yeah. Not the best. But you know, it's a lot of fun. I like the chemistry between Ryan Reynolds and Sandra Bullock, who's playing a not nice lady, and how she comes around in the end.
I'm trying to think of other just hilariously bad movies that I thoroughly enjoy. I have a thing for when they come on TV, whether I really like them or not. I do enjoy watching terrible movies because I don't know. Like I said numerous times, I like to see what it is about this movie that actually got made, how it happened. A Tin Cup is another one that is a terrible movie that I enjoy watching. Kevin Costner.
Well, it's like, you know, like on the Flophouse podcast, was this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie? Because there are those movies that are just not very good, but are kind of fun to watch. And so I would throw some of the Star Trek movies into that category because they're not all amazing filmmaking. Shall I say, it's some of them have worse problems than others, but I still enjoy, I can still get a kick out of viewing them from time to time. I don't consider them to be my favorite things to watch. Like Star Trek III is problematic in many ways, and it that's the Search for Spock, and that's a lot of soundstage that looks really, 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 really bad. A lot of makeup that's not so great. A really bad puppet. And it's just sort of all over the map. But I'll still fire up Netflix and then watch it, you know, sitting there on my couch. As well as Star Trek V, which I think is probably one of the worst Star Trek movies. I'll sit there and watch that. Because there's something about William Shatner directing himself, where he can't control his own ego or acting ability, that kind of renders it unintentionally funny. But I guess that does fall under the category of enjoying it ironically rather than like enjoying.
Hmm. I was also looking through my list of things that I've seen here. Biodome is in there. Another one that I would qualify as a bad movie, but I still enjoy it unironically, particularly for the safety dance, which is always a good thing. And then going for a movie that it's not ironic or unironic, but I've seen so many times now that it serves a purpose. It serves a purpose to just make my blood boil, which is why when it's on, I continue to watch it, although I don't know why, is, of course, American Hustle, as we have talked about numerous times. When it's on, my eyes still stick to the screen, and I watch it, and I just get viscerally angry every time I watch it because it is a terrible movie. But anyway.
I still disagree with you.
You can disagree all you want. It is a terrible movie.
Dan is so angry about American Hustle. Audience.
So angry.
Audience, as a round of audience participation, please write in to either confirm that you enjoy American Hustle or write in to say that Dan might be overreacting and calling it a terrible movie.
That's not the thing. It's not a matter of whether or not you enjoy it. There is a lot of good music in the movie. You can enjoy it for the music or the silly costumes or the wigs or whatever, but it is a bad movie. It is poorly written. It is poorly directed. It is poorly acted in many instances. There is some good acting in there, but there's just a lot of just god-awful nonsense in that movie, and I just, it makes me so angry. Anyway, we should move on.
Yeah, because your blood pressure. Yes. Heroic Origins, how did Dan and Joe meet?
I think we kind of covered that.
Yeah, we basically covered that.
Twitter. It's where we make all of our friends these days, the internet.
Who doesn't love it? Okay, so Joe, how do you defend pronouncing GIF as GIF? I don't need to. It's one of those words where you can pronounce it either way, and it doesn't matter unless you are a jerk face. So that's my verdict on that one. The inventor of it also pronounces it with a soft G, and soft G's are things, people. Like, so, you know, it's a thing. You know, I don't really care. If it really like just crushes you and makes you stop dead in your tracks and hate the world, I would encourage you to look within and examine why that has riled you so.
Translation, Joe is okay being wrong.
Yeah, you can interpret it that way. Like I said, look with it. Moving on, Aaron L.M. Goodwin. What kind of movies do we need more of? And as I had replied to him on Twitter, good ones. Because I don't really care what kind of genre comes out, but I feel like I would like to see a wide variety of things. So I would like to see more of more things. What I really don't want to see more of is more cinematic universe franchised tie-in movies that are transparently cynical about the financial benefits of tie-ins and franchises and don't really bring everything to bear on making a good film. And instead are trying to make a good financial decision. So that would be the thing that I don't think I need to see more of, would be that. Just more good stuff. It would be nice if we had more middle of the range movies like we used to back before the DVD market went away and that all got rid of. You know, things that aren't either a few million dollars independently produced or $180 million financed by tax rebates. So it would be nice if there wasn't like a giant gulf between those two things and we could get more of those films, because I think that would allow for more interesting things that don't need that burden of trying to deliver a giant weekend opening box office of $180 million and don't have the tiny budget that allows it to completely fly under most radars. So that would be my thing. What about you, Dan?
You know, a couple years ago, I probably would have said, going for the what kind of movies do we not need more of, the gritty, serious reboots of things. It's still sort of happening, but I think there's a little bit of a break in the tide there. The movies that
would you say there? This is like a pre-Dawn.
How did I know you were going to go there? No, I would not say that because that movie is going to like set us back like 10 years. Presumably, we have no knowledge. Maybe it'll be great. Of course, I'm a fan of the movies that don't take themselves too seriously and are all kinds of fun, as demonstrated by Kung Fury. It's something that you can watch and enjoy. It's not really like, you know, the most earth-shattering cinema out there, but it's super fun. And I think there's a lot of room for these sort of fun projects that they don't have to be, life-changing. They can just be fun for the sake of fun because, you know, cinema doesn't have to be serious the whole time. But the kind of movies that I like, a lot of them these days, do fall into sort of the smaller budget films just by nature of the fact that, those are really the only ones that kind of get made aside from the giant movies, as you pointed out. But like, I like the smaller scope of films, things like Drive, it's a smaller budget film, but it's a smaller scope in terms of it focuses on a small subset of people and what happens in their lives versus, the end of the world or the end of the universe or whatever. I enjoy those sort of personal movies. And of course that leads back, as all things do, to, The Social Network for me, because that's one of my favorite movies. It's ostensibly about a small group of, computer nerds, but, it's a movie that works so well on an emotional level as well as a cinematic level. So just smaller focus, I guess, is really, it's not the best way to describe it, but a movie that has very clear stakes and works really well within its world, but it doesn't have to be the largest world out there. So those are the kind of movies I enjoy and I'd like seeing more
so
of.
Yeah, so also not giant cinematic universe, cynical franchise, money, cash grabs.
Yes. So we don't need to put the risk, the millions of lives at risk from a glowy stone or something or aliens just to make a movie that has
or the San Andreas fault. So
all you really need is like a sad Carey Mulligan and you're good to go.
Okay.
You still haven't seen Drive?
No.
You're the worst.
Well, we got a year to improve that. So Rob Lewis writes in, what are your favorites? I don't know why that's plural. What are your favorite films of all time? Hashtag cats per manga.
So it's a good hashtag.
Yeah, it is. Cause I really deeply enjoy that episode. So Dan, go first. What are your favorite films of all time?
Well, we just briefly touched on one. For some reason, The Social Network found its way into my favorites of all time. There are like the classics though. I'm struggling to find one that doesn't sound like a boring answer, like Ghostbusters or Bull Durham is probably one that is not on most people's lists. It's a silly little baseball movie with Tim Robbins and Kevin Costner and Susan Sarandon. I love that movie to death. You go while I think about some more.
Okay, favorite is hard for me because I take a lot of different things into account when I pick a favorite. So it can have like a nostalgia or some emotional connection to a time in my life or something like that. Like it's not necessarily that it is probably worthy of some sort of a pedestal to put on, although there are some of those too. So people are probably gonna make fun of this, but I would put a couple of the Star Trek movies in because I find them to be a lot of fun and very influential, which would be Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 6, as well as First Contact. And then I would, say that, of course, the original Star Wars trilogy, hugely influential on me, with the A New Hope, or Star Wars, as it was known, and the Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And when I was a kid, I actually did not like Empire Strikes Back. I thought it was like dark and sad. And so I didn't enjoy it.
Isn't that kind of the point of that movie?
It is. But, you know, as an adult, I think I can appreciate that one more than I can the other two, which, of course, have a lot more of the childlikeness of Star Wars in them, shall we say. So, like, I, when I was a kid, I would just pop in the VHS cassette tape of a recording of Star Wars, which was recorded off of some TV broadcast with commercial breaks and everything, and I would fast forward through the commercial breaks, and so that was my Star Wars that I had until we got the THX box set on VHS, and that was a huge moment in home video, and then of course I liked the Return of the Jedi battle a whole lot, because I thought that was so neat. I would fast forward to just watch the end battle from that. The ship model work stuff was all a bunch of fun. And I you could probably look to that as being influential on me. But, you know, I don't think that either of those films are really that... You have a hard time making the case that they deserve to be in the pantheon of best films ever. But they you know, are personal favorites. And, of course, Godfather and Godfather 2, which I like both of them. Although I don't generally sit down to watch them very often. And American Psycho, which I watched in college for the first time because I was introduced to it by a friend who I think liked it at face value and not like in the this is a dark comedy kind of way, which is probably a red flag. But I like it in that like this is a dark comedy of like this is a bad person. These are bad people. Of course, I also like American Beauty, but I like that more for how it's shot than for the story or that stupid plastic bag. But you know, like I said, these are things where a favorite is just so subjective and weird, and it might have to do with my mood whenever I call out something. But those are generally the ones that I would probably highlight.
Yeah, see, this is how bad my memory is. I actually had to pop open my my movies here on my phone to see what I got in there. Of course, Detention, I enjoy. It's a favorite, that even though you hate it. Die Hard, of course. I think I mentioned that like several times when we did the episode, that I love it so much I shouldn't even talk about it. And same with Gross Point Blank is another one that I grew up with and just adore watching over and over again. I don't know why I didn't think of it, but back in the movies we need more of, Nightcrawler was another one of those small movies that I was trying to think of. But Out of Sight is a movie that is a favorite of mine that I love. That's Steven Soderbergh in a film that I think suits Steven Soderbergh. And George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez are both good in that movie, in my opinion. So those are favorites. I kind of like Torque, but that's kind of ironic because that movie is ridiculous and awful.
Yeah. You did remind me that I would probably also pick Home Alone, which we also talked about on the show. Again, not amazing, but it is a particularly big favorite of mine, and I actually like the second one more than the first, even though the second one is just the first one, like beat for beat, it's just amped up, and I enjoy that it is amped up and it has Tim Curry in it, and what bad thing can you say about Tim Curry? I really like Clue, which we also did. I like The Birdcage, which we also did. I like The Incredibles, which we haven't done. That was a hugely influential thing for me when I was in my computer animation class in college. Like that was like the jaw dropping. Oh my God, that's the goal. Like, won't that be amazing? Thing to move to more so than I think any other Pixar movie before or since. So that's a big one to highlight for me.
More than like Monsters, Inc. or University?
I didn't enjoy Monsters, Inc. very much, and I've not seen Monsters University.
Come on, man.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I enjoyed both of them.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, I also I like Billy Crystal, too. So anyway, we should move on. This is we could just spend the whole show just listing movies that we like.
Mm-hmm.
This is a related but kind of odd question, but are there any films you wish you had a chance to work on? Also from Rob Lewis.
Hashtag ask Steve Focused. There are a few things that I really do wish I could have worked on. Although I'm not sure if this is supposed to be like in a hypothetical sense, like if I was alive at some point in the past and able to be employed on anything, or if this is like anything during my current career that I could have worked on. So I'll probably answer it both ways. If I could have worked on any of the original Star Wars movies or on any of the original Star Trek movies, with the exception of Star Trek V, then I would have really jumped at the chance to do that. I think that either of those things would have been incredibly, would have been great to work on and be able to point to and say, wow, look at that. In terms of like in the span of my career, I guess I would point to the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot, which I don't really like very much, but I would have liked to have said that I worked on it. That would have been something. And also with the sequel, that would have also been nice to either work on either of those, even though, again, don't necessarily think they're super amazing. I just would like to say that I worked on a Star Trek movie. In terms of what's going on now, it would be really nice to work on The Force Awakens, even though totally not doing that. And so I guess this is a really depressing question, Rob, for like how I'm never going to amount to anything. Thanks, Rob.
Well, I am going to completely and totally and utterly cop out on this question, because if I were to work on any of these movies that I would like to have worked on, I would have been immediately fired, because all of the movies that I want to have been on set and watched having happened, I would just stand there and stare at the director and stare at the actors and just study what they were doing. And I would essentially not be doing my job, and I would be immediately fired after like a day or two. So all of these movies that I would love to have seen how they were made and the decisions that were made as they were happening to make this thing that I love. There's no way I could have contributed in those moments, because I would have been too dumbstruck to really, do anything. But, yeah, I got nothing. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks for the cop out, Dan.
Yeah. You're welcome. I warned you ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. And how. So moving on to a question from Carlos Franco at CF318. Everyone has terrible movies we love. My question, what guilty pleasure food do you eat while you're watching this terrible movie? Okay, so very similar to David's question, but in terms of a terrible movie, it's actually in terms of a terrible movie and the food we're eating while we're watching the terrible movie. So I would say that I generally don't eat anything while I'm watching a film.
Is that both theater and at home?
Yes. I don't like popcorn. I don't like any of the theater snacks. I don't like theater nachos. I don't like the soft pretzels. I don't like basically anything that you can get at the concession stand. When I was a teenager, I would get the big ol' giganto tub of soda that you could get, because like when you order like a small or a large, the price difference is like 10 cents, but for some reason this one you're just like, oh, I'll just go for the large then, and then you get the large and you're just like, holy cow, you could like fit your head inside of it, and so you fill that up with soda, and then you try to pace yourself drinking that through the film, so that you don't have to leave the film to go to the restroom. In my later years, I don't do that because I don't really drink soda anymore, and I don't generally buy a $4 bottle of water from the concession stand. So I usually just sit there and watch it without any form of food or drink or nourishment at all, and then afterwards and before, I will cap it off with whatever junk food happens to be around, including, you know, slice of pizza somewhere or whatever, or burgers or fries or whatever, what have you, that sort of thing. And it also depends on my mood. In terms of like at home, I also generally don't get a snack, but I'll get water, or I'll watch it with a nice adult beverage, like a Manhattan or a beer, or, you know, glass of wine. But I generally, again, don't eat food while I'm watching it, unless it's like something I've seen a bunch of times and doesn't really matter and it's just on for background noise. And then at that point, you're not really like having a guilty pleasure food while you're watching the thing. You're just having it. And then there just happens to be a movie. I hope that answered your question, Carlos.
I would say I'm surprised, but I am so not surprised by any of that. You don't enjoy any of the foods or drinks or really any of the movies at the theater. So that's just, it's so great.
So, well, Dan, I'll throw this back at you then. Do you partake of the concession stand?
Yes, I do. So when I see a movie in a theater, it is tradition, I guess. I don't know. I almost always buy a cherry icy. And,
oh, God.
Yep, I like cherry ices. And probably Junior Mints, very, 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 very rarely Red Vines because they taste like wax. But usually Junior Mints, which I share with whoever I am with. But the cherry icy is my thing that I pretty much always buy when I am seeing a movie in a theater. At home, I don't really have much of a tradition of any sorts. But there is something to be said about that adult beverage while watching a terrible movie thing, which is very fun to do, especially if it's a very bad movie. You can get extra drunk extra quick. And in that case, it's usually straight bourbon for me. But yeah, the cherry icy, that's my thing.
I feel like nothing you said was responsible.
it's the sort of the childlike experience of going to the theater and letting go and you know, letting your imagination run wild. I enjoy the
sugar rush,
having a sugar rush and the fruity beverage and you know, a very refreshing candy.
Mm. Okay, moving on from that at a pace that will hopefully burn a couple calories.
Oh wait! I did want to mention I do love movie theater popcorn. And I do love slathering it in butter, but I do not do that anymore because it gives me horrible stomach aches. Like I just, it makes me feel like I've been stabbed in the stomach after I eat half a bag of it, but I still love it, but I still don't do it.
Good story, Dan.
I love popcorn, but I can't eat it. It hurts.
Okay. Okay. So
are we being a little too honest on this show?
Maybe. So Scott Williams, Swilliams, as he is known on the interwebs, wrote in, and I think this is more of a question for you, but how far can you throw a red epic M? Hashtag literally any hashtag.
Yes. Now this is a question that required some follow up because there are a number of accessories that one could strap onto a red Epic camera that would either facilitate or inhibit the throwing of the camera itself. First of all, there's a top handle, which is a very sturdy, slim metal handle that would be that would very much help for throwing the camera. There is a side handle that is similar to sort of the strap that you get on a DSLR that would be pretty hard to use to throw the camera, actually. I asked to clarify whether or not there would be a lens on. I believe he said no, and whether or not there would be the large brick battery. So I think what it comes down to is just the body of the camera with a top handle, I believe, is what he clarified, which leaves it to in the neighborhood of, I think, somewhere like 7 pounds of basically billet aluminum. And if I was guessing red Epic M with nothing else except the top handle, I could probably throw it, I'm going to say, if I did like a discus-style spin, maybe 35 yards.
Spin's not the same thing as a throw. I'm assuming an overhand throw here.
Oh, you're assuming an overhand throw. That is a different story altogether because I would tear a rotator cuff trying to throw that thing overhand.
Okay.
See, I would definitely go for more of a spin chuck. But if I can't spin, I would still throw it sort of like a sidearm from the handle.
Would you granny toss it?
No. Not between the legs because you would probably bust yourself in the shin and it would hurt a lot. But I would just sort of, you know, twist a bit and then chuck it sideways. And if I couldn't do the full spin or two, I could probably only get maybe 20, 25 yards out of it.
Okay. Yeah. That I have nothing for this. This is the average airspeed of a African or a European swallow. So next question, how long can Joe talk about this person before Dan doesn't want to do the show anymore? And you know, I don't really want to hurt the show by making that happen. So I won't participate in this dare to make me converse over this person. So sorry, Scott.
I didn't open the link. This is the Star Trek lady with the forehead, right?
Yes, she's a Bajoran. Do you know about the people of Bajor, Dan?
A baby Bajoran?
No. You don't wear them. So the Bajorans were an oppressed people that were occupied by the Cardassian forces. It was basically, a situation where for many years they were taken advantage of and forced into labor by a spacefaring civilization, which doesn't really make any sense on the face of it. And this is the situation that also sets up Deep Space Nine, where there's a space station that has transitioned from Cardassian rule to Bajoran rule, and the Federation comes in to help administrate, and then they discover the wormhole. So the Bajorans and the Cardassians are very complex, and she is from a Bajoran background. And this episode does involve Cardassian plots, and she's on the bridge of the USS Enterprise. So this is not actually a Deep Space Nine episode. It is a Star Trek The Next Generation episode. And those are some important facts. Do you know that the little pips, the little round things, indicate rank on the neck area of the uniform?
I didn't know there was things on the neck.
Okay,
area.
I feel like I've sufficiently sapped your will to live, so we will move on.
I was staring. I have a teddy bear with a mustache on the corner of my desk.
Okay, and you were just staring at your teddy bear with a mustache.
Mm-hmm. He's wearing a shirt that says "I heart you." I think it was a Valentine's Day present
to yourself.
No,
from Amanda.
That would be weird if I bought it for myself.
Why? You didn't specify. So I was just assuming.
Am I that sad that your immediate assumption is that I bought it for myself?
I don't know. You eat movie theater popcorn until it hurts. So I don't do that anymore.
I eat Junior Mints. They're very refreshing. Although the stadium style seating of the movie theater combined with the Junior Mints really does just make me think of that Seinfeld episode.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think there's anybody who's getting like open heart surgery in the rows below me.
I hope not. I don't think they clean up that well after each movie.
No, the floors are very sticky.
That's super gross. The next question we have is from definitely Jeff Ruberg. and why don't you watch more interesting movies? So I don't know.
I'm assuming he means like German expressionistic type films or French subtitled films or something. What's an interesting movie?
Considering he has a podcast about Digimon, and that is his major interest in life, I don't really think that it is about French movies or German movies. I think it is mostly about perhaps Japanese anime or Digimon. I think there was maybe a Digimon. I don't know if there was a Digimon movie. I know there's a Pokemon movie.
I was just going to ask
Pokemon and Digimon are basically the same thing. And if you say that to somebody that's a fan of Digimon, they super duper love it. So I'm going to say it right now. Basically the same stuff, and interesting feedback would be nice. Thanks, Jeff.
I had a conversation with somebody about this not that long ago, actually, that apparently it is a common misconception that Pokemon came first, but Digimon actually came first.
I don't know.
Apparently Digimon predated Pokemon, but Pokemon came to the United States first. But I should clarify that the conversation I was having was with a 9-year-old, so it wasn't that well thought out. So I that's all the information I got out of it.
Okay. Well, you can talk to Jeff.
I don't think I need any more information than that.
No.
Anyway.
Nobody does. So Todd Dischendorf.
Hey, Todd.
Yes. I, Todd, who is very nice to us on Twitter and sometimes retweets the show and stuff. He has had many questions for us, and he is by far the person who has sent in the most questions. Out of everyone, I take that back. Second most questions. And so he starts off with how you been, which is a reference, of course, to something you might be familiar with, Dan, which would be Where You Bean.
Yeah, hashtag Where You Bean, the coffee place over on Chandler and 48th, for those keeping track. I have not been back to Where You Bean in a very long time, particularly because I found another pseudo local coffee shop, which is still a 40-minute drive away, but they have much better coffee. So if I am, in fact, going to leave my house for 25 minutes to go to Where You Bean, I might as well just, you know, stay in the car for another 15 minutes or something and make my way down to downtown Chandler, where they have a lovely coffee place called Peixoto, which is a very weird name, but it's Brazilian. And they have much better coffee. And there's places to eat food around there, other than a Waffle House.
Ah, so, well, I guess that answered that question. Can't really do anything with the name of the
other. Right, but I haven't been to Where You Bean.
Yes. Well, there's not much we can do with the name of the coffee shop that you're going to now. So thanks for killing that.
It has an X in it. It's very strangely spelled. It has an X in it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay. Well, X marks the spot. Has Joe learned how to pronounce meme correctly? Next question.
Do it again. Let's check it. Let's check it out.
Meme.
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 All right. I think you got it. Mm-hmm. It was the second one.
Meme?
Meme.
Okay. Well, now that we've got mem corrected, we can move on to, since Dan doesn't like Luke's theme from Star Wars, when exactly did he die on the inside?
I think I already answered this one on Twitter. What did I say? June 2001 or was it July 2001? It was, I believe it was
1999. Oh, no, it was 2001. You're right.
It was 2001. It was definitely 2001. I remember that. I believe it was the beginning of the summer of 2001.
And yes, the halcyon days.
Halcyon days of high school.
Oh, Dan. Wasn't that graduation then? You still had another year then, right?
Yeah. May 2002. What was it, March? May? I don't know when people graduate. Anyway, I graduated in 2002.
Yeah, it would be May. So, sorry, Dan. Sorry that you've been dead inside for 15 years. That sounds pretty uncomfortable. But
it's not as bad as you would think.
Okay. Nothing like rattling around loose inside then.
Yeah. No, we shouldn't talk about how old and decrepit my back and knees are. But yeah, I've begun the rotting process after dying.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure we're making progress. So how long before Canadian government incentives for the film industry drive Joe from his beloved adopted home of West Hollywood? I don't live in WeHo. I live near there.
Some good restaurants over there.
Not worth driving through. Santa Monica Boulevard is kind of awful for traffic. And I just don't care. So I'm much more content with other areas of the city. But I am content enough with my current employment situation that I am not looking to move and cross the border to Canada. Sorry to our Canadian listeners. Maybe we have maybe we have more than one. The tax incentive situation is not great, and it could change at any time. And visas can change, and then you're in another country, and blah, 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 blah. Just, it's not generally great. I don't view it as something that I would enjoy doing.
So you haven't started the countdown clock on the move to Canada?
No, this is not the final countdown. Okay.
That's going to be in my head for the next week now. Thank you.
Well, that's the beauty of that song. So Laser Unicorns, arcade game, robot or not?
I'm going to say robot because it is sentient. It does have a personality. It is offended by the player who kicked it, I believe, and he decided to fight back and shoot lasers everywhere. And he was smart enough to use the quarter to refill his laser guns. So I'm going to say yes, robot.
I'm going to say no, because he's a computer, technically. He can just move in this one function.
He has legs and arms, though.
That's not really a requirement for a robot. You could have wheels and be a robot.
I know, but in the Venn diagram, the things with legs and arms are in the robot camp and not in the not robot camp.
Okay.
Name a non-robot that has arms and legs. I think that makes my point.
Okay. I don't know. I was just trying to be argumentative because robot or not's no fun if we both agree, but I really don't have an argument. This would probably be better if Jason Snell and John Siracusa did that.
Yeah, they have a great show. They should just go listen to that.
Yeah. It is a market they have successfully cornered, and we dare not attempt taking that.
You don't really want to corner a robot because they will fight back.
Yes. Unless they don't know how to manage corners because their visual system is impaired. So how many Silverhawks action figures do you still own? ? One here, and then he has a picture of the Buzzsaw guy. I don't have any more of them because, like all of my toys, they have been dispersed through various yard sales and donations because it wasn't worth shipping across the country for nostalgia reasons to have in a box somewhere and then take out and say, oh, I remember that, and then close the box and then put it away.
How many did you have?
I had quite a few. I had the Silverhawks ship, which has that detachable front section that like fires off on like little wheels. It was quite dangerous as 80s toys go. And then you'd put the characters inside the little blue plastic cockpit things that would flip open. And they had little pegs so that they could stand on the top of it. And I had the cowboy guitar guy. And I had the green guy who was added later, who wasn't in the opening credits. And my brother had this bat, which was supposed to be like the evil thing that went sort of opposite with the ship, which is like this big plastic bat thing. And Monstar, who was the villain. And then I think he had like the bull thing and stuff. So it's not really that interesting, but there are a lot of toys. And I don't even remember the names. But I remember the theme song because they're partly metal, partly real.
Mm-hmm. Because metal is not real.
Yes. I didn't write it, Dan. So moving on to Simon Yang, _ Simon Yang, YANG, # who, # are, # your, # favorite, # directors, ? The punctuation is important, I feel like.
Yes. All of that was very well done. Thank you, Simon. Mm-hmm. Are you starting or should I?
I was hoping you would do it. And I'm going to just make this the Joe podcast about all the questions Joe can answer.
All of Joe's Silverhawks action figures. Well, of course, let's get it out of the way. David Fincher, big fan. I mentioned briefly Soderbergh earlier with Out of Sight. I like Steven Soderbergh a lot when used appropriately, but there are a lot of movies that are just weird, and he does weird things in them, so I don't necessarily love those movies, but I think he is a very talented director. I've grown to appreciate Nicholas Winding Refn's insanity. He is a very odd man, evidently, based on all evidence that we have. Of course, Edgar Wright, big fan of Edgar Wright. He does many great, crazy things in all of his movies, and they all work out for a number of reasons, particularly because Simon Pegg works out really well in them as well. Let's see, who else is a director that I enjoy? Oh, well, of course, Joseph Kahn, since we got to bring that up. I got to keep rubbing that in because he is also insane in a different way than Edgar Wright, but I enjoy his style of directing.
Okay. My list is shorter because I don't have any favorites.
You have no favorite directors? You don't even want to go like old school and go like Coppola or something?
No, because every director has good movies, and every director seemingly, usually, also has bad movies. So even if I like a director, they've also done stuff that I don't like. And so then it's just like, well, then is this like my favorite director for any particular reason? And it's like, no, I just kind of like that movie he made that one time.
Well, to be clear here, we're talking about the director. Can you evaluate their directing performance separate from whether or not you like the movie?
I think the two can go hand in hand most of the time. Because I feel like the directing can really save things in a lot of cases when things go south. Not always, but you know, so yeah, I generally just don't have a favorite director. I mean, of course I like movies Sam Mendes does. I don't like every movie Sam Mendes does. I like, you know, the John McTiernan, many of his films, but not all of John McTiernan's films. I like, some of Toby Hooper's films, but not all of Toby Hooper's films, and not even the one that he's most famous for, which is a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I don't actually like very much. And
what about, can we agree on Abrams as a director?
I don't really like him.
Okay. I like his directing skills.
Yeah, but he's so involved in all of the other parts of the movie that I don't like. Like you're saying, you can separate directing from all of the other things, but he's very much in like this showrunner vein of like touching everything on the film that isn't just directing, like writing, all of the development stuff, like just kicking around story ideas. Like he's not just brought in at the last minute and then directs a script someone hands
him. Well, nobody really is. But if we're going to go down that path, let's talk about Tarantino as somebody who's got his hands all over everything. And he kind of smears the director title over every piece of that movie. And I think he is admirable, whether you can talk about the successfulness of his films or not. By the time this episode goes up, we will have already done that recently.
And this does circle back to our first episode, where we discussed Tarantino, and I said, I just don't care for him. I feel like he's overhyped, and I feel like, a lot of times he repeats himself, and, that I understand him pulling from the vocabulary of previous films, and that it really speaks to him, and he brings that, with a new perspective to an audience that may not have seen it before. So it's not like, it's not like cribbing as much as it is like making an homage and making people appreciate something else. But I just generally don't always like the way the movie comes out. And there are some of his films that I like, and then there's some of his films that I don't like. And so I'm not really a Tarantino fan. Like there are directors that I'm more inclined to say that I don't like than there are directors that I'm inclined to say that I like. In terms of like the influence I feel they have on projects.
What about, I can't believe I missed it the first time around, but Scorsese?
I don't like everything.
No, but he's definitely a director that gets his hands all over the movie and he does his thing and, the movies are better because of his involvement.
I guess.
We'll get around to Wolf of Wall Street one of these days.
I don't know. I'm not so won over by the idea that of having like a favorite director that he can come in and fix directing problems and like everything that's wrong with the movie and is just always amazing. I don't know. I feel like the movie is such a standalone thing that I just don't evaluate it that way.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
We can move along.
Matthew Wilson, MWIL_CL. What movies do you, parentheses, mostly Joe, in parentheses, even like, ? Winky face, # joke well, sort of. Well, thank you for writing in, Matthew. The movies that I like, I feel like we covered already. And there are a lot of
Star
things.
Trek.
Yeah, there, but not just Star Trek, Dan. But thanks for abbreviating that.
Star Wars as well.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. there are a lot of things that I enjoy, which I also still pick apart anyways, or the area of things that I can appreciate, but neither actively enjoy nor hate is also a large area of films to discuss. So yeah, there's tons of things. The impression that I hate things is, I feel overblown, that there are very few things on this podcast that I actually hate. Detention being one of them, and Snowpiercer being the other, that I would choose to highlight as like really just terrible. And
we can agree on one of those.
Yeah. The fact that we both agree that Snowpiercer is a terrible movie, should really let you know how bad that movie is. Audience,
it boggles my mind. People still hold that up as a great movie. And I see all over Tumblr and various places, people taking screenshots and talking about how artful the cinema is. And it's just like, which movie did you watch? Because not the same one we watched.
No, I don't know what horrible brainwashing befell everyone. But yeah, I do not agree that that is a good movie. And so, yes, there are things that I like, and there are relatively few things that I, like, hate. And as I mentioned, those are the two that we've talked about on here that I hate. So, yes. And in terms of things that we've talked about that I really, really like, there's Last Starfighter, there's Galaxy Quest, there's Clue, there's et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, there's plenty of things that I do like. Thank you for writing in, Matthew, with your joke well sorta.
I appreciate it as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Matthew. Moving on to the origin of Defocus Your Faves, Rye, Amidon. It's Amidon, right? Is that the proper pronunciation?
Yes. Although, at first, when he started following me on Twitter and replying to things, and his name was Rye Amidon with no space between the two, or no character defining what the difference was, I thought it was Rye Amidon. like some sort of, like...
Some ancient Greek sort of warrior?
I don't know. But apparently it is Rye Amidon. So, Rye... What's worse, the color grading at Groundhog Day or the food at LACC, the conference hall downtown? Hashtag defocus your faves.
Yeah, and see, this is, again, how bad my memory is. I remember talking about the color grading at Groundhog Day, but I don't remember us making sort of egregious commentary about how bad it was. I mean, of course, there's film grain all over the damn place, but you said something about how it was very cool. Is that what I recall?
Yeah, I think I actually said that I quite liked a lot of it, that I liked, you know, I had appreciation for it because it was developed, you know, when they were doing chemical grading for films. I think they got a good look and feel for it.
Yeah.
So maybe this is his personal grudge against it. I don't know. I thought it was okay. Now, the food... at the convention center, I can't speak to because I never deigned to eat it. But Dan, you confessed on a previous episode that you ate food at the LA Convention Center.
Yeah, that is very clearly the winner here. I forgot to mention on the previous one, I think, that one of the highlights of the cuisine at the Los Angeles Convention Center is a rolling cart from Quiznos, where they sell sandwiches. And I believe I had a Quiznos sandwich from there. So the worst thing between the two of these is far and away the food at the Los Angeles Convention Center.
Yes. And his next question, what was a movie that had an early and enduring creative influence on you? How did you end up in your lines of work? Okay, so yeah. Two questions. Let's answer the first one.
Do you have a particular movie that you can point to and say that's the one that pushed me into this?
I would have to point mainly to Star Wars and Star Trek, although I wouldn't be able to pick out a singular thing. And I think also something that really did influence me was reading Rainbow, a series from back in the 80s and 90s, with LeVar Burton as the host. Was going on at the same time that he was still Geordi LaForge on the television series, and there was an episode where he did a behind the scenes on how the show was made, and a segment of it was talking to the visual effects supervisor Rob Legato, and he walked through all the different stuff of how they shot the model upside down and the different passes that they were running and how they put it all together. And while that's not an incredibly specific thing that he discussed, it still fascinated me. So that also was hugely influential because I still remember it. And I think I had mentioned this on previous episodes, including, I think, our Galaxy Quest episode.
I don't think you mentioned the Reading Rainbow because I would have made a joke about how it's a good thing you didn't end up as a writer because, you know, take a look. It's in a book and all that.
Yeah, well, I can fly anywhere. That's not true. There are places you can't fly. And human beings in general can't fly. They require vehicular assistance to do so.
Mm-hmm. Like in The Rocketeer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was a good jetpack. You want to go right into the next portion of the question, or should I do the first part now?
Oh, you should do it now.
Well, I was kind of pushed into this through my cousin's influences on film. He was a Tarantino lover from the very beginning, where he was in love with Reservoir Dogs and later in love with Pulp Fiction. And the first couple films that – well, films – high eight video parody films that we shot in his garage when we were like – 13 years old or something, were basically just blatant Reservoir Dogs ripoffs of these small children in ill-fitting suits that had plastic guns and were ostensibly robbing banks and things like that. It's very clear to me that the point in my life where I decided that movies was a thing that was large and fascinating and something I wanted to explore was Rushmore, which I'm sure doesn't come out in my influence at all anymore. But when Rushmore came out, my brain kind of exploded. And of course, you know, Wes Anderson was just becoming a thing at that time, really. I mean,
the style at the time.
Yes. I fell down the, you know, let's go watch Bottle Rocket a million times. Let's watch every little special feature of Rushmore over and over again and follow him along. I kind of fell off the Wes Anderson train for a while. I really liked Grand Budapest recently. But
was the Wes Anderson train named the Jarling Express?
No. I don't know that I've seen that movie all the way through because I didn't particularly enjoy the best that I've seen. But anyway, yeah, Rushmore. Rushmore's my answer. That's the one that kind of kicked it off in an odd way.
That's not what I expected. How did you end up in your lines of work? So I went to school for my line of work, for 4 years and graduated. And that was for a degree in computer animation. You spend the whole entire time putting together a senior thesis, which is the majority of your demo reel, and then some of your other student projects can make up other material on demo reel. And then you show that to the recruiters that would come to the school, and you'd also send it out to other places. And then no one wanted me for 4 months. Other friends of mine got recruited before the end of school, they did well. And so I was a little jealous, and I was living at home with my mom in Tampa. And then, the call came in that they needed somebody to start right away, and actually it was 10 years ago that I graduated, in May of 2005. So yay, 10 years. And I went. I got a call from Sony Pictures Imageworks. They wanted me to come out there if I could come out there as soon as possible. We're talking a matter of like a week and a half, and so I said yes in a I'm horribly scared kind of a way. Had a phone interview with a CG supervisor, who, in a very strange way, I didn't end up working for until many, many years later. Because when I was hired on the project, I was actually worked for a different CG supervisor. And I had to fly immediately out. I worked at Sony Pictures as an associate technical director. And that mainly involved like running automated scripts and setting up files and copying things. It was not a highly artistic role. But because they were so strapped for people, I wound up having quite a few finals on that. And then I went in the span of 2 months and pulling like 80 hour weeks, et cetera, more than that in some cases. After that, I had to start all over again when I went into my next project at the same facility. And I was on open season. And then I had to sort of ingratiate myself again with the CG supervisor. So that was an interesting process. It wasn't until Spider-Man 3 where I was elevated to being a lighting and compositing technical director, because they ask you to do both of those roles, lighting and compositing, which are usually divided up between two different artists at Sony at the time. And I did that for many, many years. And that was how I got into the industry, into basically the role that I'm in now, because it's just been different aspects of that since then.
Fascinating.
Not really.
A little. I mean, it's interesting to me, and I'm sure to the audience.
Hope so, because otherwise they tuned in for nothing. So, Dan, how did you end up in your line of work?
I feel like I should just kind of point people to that episode of Storm Immortal where I got into it, but I'll give you the Cliff's Notes version of it now. I had, as mentioned before, made terrible little short films in my cousin's garage with him. I also used video production as an excuse to get out of class in middle school and high school, where we would do video announcements during homeroom. So I would get to leave class and go screw around in this room in the back of the library where we'd play with video cameras and we'd make a live news broadcast and do all kinds of stupid crap. And then I went off to college to be an engineer, and I am a terrible engineer because while I love math and science and all that stuff, I don't like doing it. So I ended up bailing on engineering school and going to film school because I knew a guy who was going to film school and he was doing things with cameras that had film and these colorful charts. And it's like, yeah, I could do that. Why not? Because I had Adobe Premiere on my computer and I was a computer nerd. So, I went to film school for, 2.5 years before I got hired, at Intel to work in their internal media department, where I was an editor and then very quickly became a, what did they call me? Digital artist. We just made up our own titles because it's a corporation. You can do that. And then I became a director and then a creative director. And over the course of about 7 years, I kind of learned every role from post all the way up to production because, I won't get into it much, but the group started off very small, about 5 people, and then grew into this sort of like larger parent organization of 40 people and a lot more big projects, more money, all that sort of stuff. And, they needed somebody to sort of take the reins and make a bunch of ridiculous, silly videos. And of course, that was back when I had an imagination. So I did a lot of that stuff. So, I shot all of the stuff in their clean rooms, which is a debacle of a process. A lot of their newsreel footage, a lot of their CEO sort of executive style, keynote presentation videos, and, just sort of learned the craft all the way up until the point where, I decided to bail and go out on my own, which is where I have been for the past 2.5 years. So ta-da.
Yay.
Whew, that was way too long.
Yeah. I can't help but notice you said creative director. Isn't it really for us to decide?
Sure. No, that's,
just a joke.
Yeah. Yes. No, we did have the ability to create our own business cards, which would get sent off to Kinko's and printed by the thousand and sent back to you without really anyone ever fact checking them. So you could put whatever you want on the business card. And I think I probably still have an entire box of unused Intel business cards that say creative director on them.
You know what we should do? We should have a virtual storefront where people can sign up to get a signed copy of a real, authentic Dan Sturm card sent to them. I think that's what the listeners really want.
If they want that, they can send us a tweet or an email. I assume we will get precisely 0 people, but yeah, we'll I'll send you one of my terrible old business cards if you want one.
Better living through brand engagement. And now moving on to Andrzej Tomic's feedback here, whose name I always mangle, but I love him so dearly, and I always use the Z over his last name because I respect him so much. I just can't, but my words, the things, like, I can't say the things. But he, like you said, is the guy who runs the Storming Mortal podcast. He is huge in Slovenia. Literally, he's quite tall. But he also is a prolific podcaster in Slovenian, which is different than English. But he has an English podcast, and he sometimes appears on the some of the clockwise episodes on Relay FM. So keep an eye out for him. Can't miss him in a crowd. And which is Dan's favorite Joe makes a Star Trek connection to one of the actors in a film moment? I don't know if we had any of those that you would probably classify as a favorite moment, but if you did, what would it be?
I gotta say, it was probably the one where, I'm kidding, I totally tune out every time you do that. I have no idea when you say things.
Yeah, that's what I thought. moving on. I love you guys, comma, even though I haven't been on the show. Still, I mean, come on. Really? Anyway, great, you know, show. Kissy face.
With the time difference, we might actually be able to get him on because, of course, we record at 9 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays usually. So maybe we can address the time difference for him.
No, but I think he's asleep right now.
Yeah, probably. I mean, but he'll have to get up early if he wants to be on the show.
Okay. We'll make him work for it.
Make him work for it.
It'll be totally worth it. He's great. And I was also on Storming Mortal, and we'll probably have both episodes of Storming Mortal that we were on individually in our notes, because that's the kind of show this is. And
one with notes.
One with notes. This is the kind of fun that you know you're having. It's fun with notes. And then moving on, from the Twitter handle, a boy named Boom, we have, which I'll refer to from here on out as B&B. B&B has a few questions for us. Typically, there is a film that gets kids to want to work in movies. Do you both have one? And if so, what movie? We've covered this already, but I don't think there's anything we actually agree on, though. Pretty safe to say there was nothing that influenced both of us simultaneously to want to get it into film, since obviously our stories have been so different.
Yeah, you would think that since we're of a similar generation, only about a year apart, that we would have one particular film that we both point to and say was such a great movie of the time, and it really kind of pushed us to get into the business. But no.
Nope. Not even Star Wars, because Dan doesn't like space. Other than all the K's and R's, is there anything technology-wise that seems exciting to you both? Do you have any dream technologies that you would like to see?
This is an interesting question. I we've lamented over the standards issues numerous times, but the HDR stuff is fascinating. I find that very interesting on a number of levels, because I've played around with a little bit of HDR, like hacking do-it-yourself kind of stuff.
You hack the HDRs?
You know, stereo 3D rigs, when you have them laying around, when you don't actually use them for 3D, can be used for HDR, mostly in very distasteful ways, but there are interesting things.
But isn't that like tone mapping? That's not really
yes.
Like... Okay.
Yes, it kind of is. But as a technology geek, first and foremost, I enjoy playing with the various tools, camera, post-production tools, or whatever it may be at my disposal. And that's kind of what my job at Intel was. Like, we had cameras and computers laying around, so play around with them and see what you can come up with. And HDR is one of those things that I still think is fascinating. But the K's, and who cares about it? What are R's?
That would be an HDR, I'm assuming.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
But there you go.
I also like the idea of HDR, not HDR tone mapping, but the because I think that always just has a look. It's not a great look. But I am interested in the idea of a greater range of color being available and of luminance being available. So it would be nice, but does it excite me? No, not really. It's more money I got to spend, jerkwads. And it's probably not going to work right. And everybody's going to do it differently. And it's going to be like 10 years before anybody figures this all out. So,
All right. So let me ask you a question. Do you have any opinions on VR stuff? Because I kind of do.
My opinion on VR fluctuates. As a storytelling device, I am deeply skeptical for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is that with a movie, you sit back and you're on the ride where somebody has to show you everything. In a VR thing, you are participating and you have to control the environment. And if the environment and the characters around you don't behave in a way that engages with what you want, it can break the experience for you. And you become very aware of it not being a... It not actually holding up, and it's sort of like that, you know, something analogous I guess would be in a movie where it doesn't allow you to suspend disbelief. Several times that comes up, you know, like somebody does a crazy car stunt, somebody shoots somebody and they fly across a room funny, that kind of thing. Like, that is, you know, that ruins the suspension of disbelief. Like, in a VR game, if there's a conversation tree and it's not what you want to say, then that's going to ruin it. If there's a thing that you say and the character says it to you with just sort of a rote response, if it's not changing responses every time you say something, if it's just cycling through different animations and you can pick up on that, it's all going to break the experience. All the things that you associate with video games being limitations, where they have to design for a lot of different outcomes with a tree of decisions that they need to calculate and path for, so that they can all have a bunch of different outcomes depending on whatever you choose. That also degrades the quality, because you can't make, you can't like do it for camera in that context. You can't just have the characters running and explosions only on one side. What if I decide I want to turn down this alley? What if I decide I want to break this glass? Like in Half-Life 2, where you go to break the glass and then it just makes a thudding noise, because that doesn't make any freaking sense. But, you know, there's all these limitations, because in essence, I think VR has more in common with video games than it does with film. And that when I see stuff like VR storytelling or, VR filmmaking, I kind of like raise a little question mark, and I'm just, you know, very, very skeptical that it really is an experience like film where you feel immersed in that way. I think it is much more like playing a good video game. It is that kind of experience, because it still has an artificiality to it in the way that you interact with the world. And with film, you're not interacting with the world, so it is a different passive experience. You know, who's to say, over time, the infinite, you know, scale of time, that something might improve with that technology. Something from Star Trek, to reference again here, that often gets brought up is, of course, the holodeck, a magical place where you could, well, not magical, technological, but any sufficiently advanced technology appears to be magic. But you walk into the holodeck and you say, hey, I want to be in Victorian Europe. I don't know why. Victorian Europe seems pretty terrible, but you can be there.
About the Viking Age.
You know, or the Viking Age. You can go to the Viking Age. And there are laser raptors. And then you get to interact with those. And then it behaves in a way that you would expect. And it's great, and you love it. And there are safety protocols, so nobody dies. Usually. Sometimes. And so that's how the holodeck works. And it's great. And it works well as a storytelling tool. And a lot of people really want that out of like a VR experience. Seeing how this eventually get to that point would be very good. Oculus has a few different programs right now where they're actually even trying to do like sort of Pixar-esque, Disney-esque, like little short story things, in VR. They announced like their hedgehog thing a little while ago. And they hired on, Patrick Osborne, who directed the Feast short, which was in front of, Big Hero 6, which is the one with the dog. And the cel shaded one with the dog, and so he did that, and they're trying to do something else differently with that. It is in a way more cinematic to hire on these people and pursue these kinds of projects, but at the same time, video games tried to do that too many times over the years, where they try to bring in people from film, they try to bring in Steven Spielberg, they try to bring in different directors to give them advice. They try to bring in different concept artists from film and television. They try to bring in, you know, to do things that can elevate the experience to be cinematic in a sense. But I feel like there is an element of cinema that you can't capture in video games yet for technological reasons, and also for man-hour reasons of trying to program for every inevitable response that is possibly possible. It seems like you'd need like some sort of a massive, you know, predictive supercomputer that's able to process on the fly and come up with the appropriate response based on your previous responses and experience of other players and stuff like that. And I don't see like humans being able to program that for a bunch of video games every single, you know, couple months. It just doesn't seem feasible for that to be a rewarding and engaging experience. But anyway, I'm going to pass the talking stick to you now, Dan. You may talk.
That was a slightly more elaborate version of what I was going to say, in as much as I find it fascinating, both technologically and artistically, just the idea of what you could potentially do with it, but I don't think it has any place in filmmaking.
I just think it is so fundamentally different in the way that it works with the audience, that you are the participant rather than just a passive observer of the events that are unfolding. Mm-hmm. And it also is technically different in terms of what needs to be made. Like you spend all your time on some detail and somebody's facing the other direction. So it's not the same thing. It is very much it has a lot more in common with video games.
Yeah, and I like the idea of exploring different places, whether they be past, present, future ideas, like, you know, wandering around ancient Egypt or something, or taking a guided tour where you could see, like, you know, a time lapse of the history of ancient Greece or something, where you can actually watch things happen in front of you and you can actually move around and look at different things in your environment. I think that would be cool. I don't think that has anything to do with cinema, but I look forward to seeing where they go with this. Hopefully the goggles get smaller and more comfortable.
Oh, I think that's just going to have to happen. People wouldn't even wear 3D glasses, Dan. So, you know, God save them for wearing this stuff. And let's move on from this dead horse, this virtual dead horse. If Dan hates Arizona so much, why does he keep living in Arizona?
This is a complicated question that nobody wants the answer to, but suffice it to say, this is where all of my family is for some crazy reason.
So the important takeaway here is Dan cares deeply about his family. Thank you for writing in, B&B. Would Joe ever move to Vancouver, as we've covered? I don't know about, but immediately, anytime soon, no. If Joe had to, would he move to Vancouver or back to Florida? There is no industry in Florida that does what I currently do, so the answer would be no. If there suddenly was, if Florida suddenly participated in the crazy tax incentive schemes that lure companies across state and country lines, then maybe. But you know, it's just that's just such a hypothetical thing that I can't even anticipate. When are we getting Defocused merch?
Hopefully soon.
Yes. Maybe you already have it. No, you
hashtag
probably don't.
Teaser.
Yes. Hashtag future podcast, past podcast. So. Will you
Days of Future podcast?
Yes. Days of Future podcast. Will you both do a SIGGRAPH timed live show / meetup? We had joked about this previously. And as much as I have a gigantic aversion to meeting people and humans in general, I might, you know, try to do that if it would work out in a way. SIGGRAPH, I forget exactly when it falls, but I think I should be able to, if not go for the day, at least meet people afterwards. And again, I don't know if you'll be in town, but if you are, maybe we can arrange something. In terms of a live show, we would have to have a good recording space for that and recording equipment and some ability to host other people. Otherwise, I don't feel like anyone would be really rewarded by us having a live show. Other than Dan and I would look at each other awkwardly across the table, which I don't know if that really translates well to audio podcasting. So
it would be very distracting. I'm sure it would be a very poorly done episode.
Yes, yes. As we've heard from other podcasters that have had in-person live shows, that it doesn't always like really help with anything. So,
but meetup is good. Meetup is just drinking and talking to people face to face.
Yeah, you can have a good time without drinking, Dan. I just feel like I need to say that at this point of the podcast. I mean, it would be nice to meet people. There are quite a few listeners in the LA area, so it would be a good excuse to participate. But we wouldn't know that yet, even when this is released.
Well, SIGGRAPH is from the 9th to the 13th of August, so that's coming up relatively soon. But we'll see what we can do. I think SIGGRAPH butts right up against a trip to glorious old Ohio that I have to partake in. But it's potentially, we'll see. If I can make it out there, we'll definitely do something.
What's your favorite part of Ohio?
Probably the White Castle off the freeway.
Okay, so B&B asks, have either of you experienced, heavy air quotes for some reason, Dolby Atmos? If so, what do you think? I can't remember it. I think I have sat in a theater that was equipped with Dolby Atmos. And to my immediate recollection, Dolby Atmos is their sound mixing specialty stuff. I thought the sound was good, but the fact that I can't remember what movie it was or say that other movies have had bad sound, other than saying I didn't like Christopher Nolan's film, that should probably lead you to believe that I'm not capable of discerning the quality difference that might be provided by Dolby Atmos. I think we had already talked about this, Dan. You didn't even, you weren't sure either, right?
Well, you know, just off the top of my head, I believe Dolby Atmos is the name of a surround sound technology introduced by Dolby Laboratories in April 2012, first utilized on Pixar's Brave, and the first installation was in the Dolby Theater in Hollywood, California, just if my memory serves me correctly. And I think there's something in the neighborhood of 2,000 theaters that have this technology installed, but No, I can't recall an instance of having, I feel like I have been to a movie that had, Dolby sound in it. I don't know if it's this Atmos version, but, I got nothing.
Yeah. Sorry. I hope that didn't mean anything to you personally, B&B. Next question. Would you say what would you say to somebody who wanted to get into VFX now? I would say, do not. I would say, turn around, go away, do something else. Make money, live your life. If this is your passion, this will kill your passion. This will sap your will to live. It is not sustainable as a career for the rest of your life. If you start down this dark path, forever will it... anyway, it's not just not good. I wouldn't do it. It is not worth, especially the financial investment, if you are pursuing an actual college certificate or degree. The rates for schools now are even more ridiculous than when I went. So I, again, strongly advise people not to do it. And whatever you do, don't get involved in some cockamamie program like Dave School or Full Sail or Savannah College of Art and Design. Anything where they're just pumping out people for money. Although SCAD's not so bad. You just have to say SCAD all the time. But like anything where there's a lot of money being contributed and not a lot of people graduate to do things that you're really happy about, be very deeply skeptical of the program, especially Art Institute programs. I think that goes without saying. A giant nationwide chain of schools is probably always a red flag. And I don't know if you feel similarly about education in this country, Dan, but I feel it is just not worth it to get into this industry where prospects are currently so low.
Well, as a person who is molding the future minds of America, particularly in the post-production industry, I have a few thoughts. Most of them are similar to what you said, maybe just not with quite the same tone. It is definitely a very difficult industry. There's not a great deal of potential for growth or a healthy lifestyle when it comes to work-life separation, that sort of thing. There's definitely not a lot of permanency, especially when it comes to tax incentives moving people around, which is very difficult. But, you know, people who want to get into VFX, the term get into VFX probably meant something different to people a few years ago than it means to me now. The idea of understanding the VFX process and being familiar enough to sort of, you know, if you are a director or a DP, the ability to sit down and hack together and edit is an important thing. I think these days, the ability to do some basic compositing is probably as important as being able to know how to edit used to be. So I think the VFX skills are incredibly useful and will be even more useful for filmmakers in any role going forward in the future. Anyone who wants to do anything in the business, they're going to have to confront the use of visual effects just for, you know, budgetary reasons or for just realistic production reasons. But in terms of making visual effects specifically your career, it is kind of a disaster at the moment. I was going to use a much more provocative phrase, but I won't. As much as I make my living as a visual effects artist, I still don't really call myself a visual effects artist full time because I still consider myself sort of a director because I try and use the full sort of skill set of things that I've accrued. I'm not the best at any one particular thing, but I feel the need to know all of them because just I can't get by without knowing all of these different aspects of working. And I think that is where people who are interested in learning visual effects should focus. And I'm not suggesting become a generalist where you learn everything, but you do need to have an understanding of and a basic skill set in all of these things to be successful these days. And, you know, sort of separating that from, you know, I'm going to go work for a company and work my way up, which doesn't necessarily work out to be super promising for people these days. Having the skill set to go off and do the things that you want to do, kind of, you know, entrepreneurial in a filmmaking sense, which is a terrible thing to say. That is useful, but, trying to work your way up, in a big company as a visual effects artist, not so good.
Yeah, but to go off of a couple things that you mentioned, if you want to know more about VFX, not necessarily to do it as a career, then of course there's always things like FX PhD courses, there's Lynda courses or whatever, and they'll even provide little toy assets for you to manipulate and do things to in order to feel like you have progressed and learned an important aspect of production.
Make them walk like John Wayne.
Yes, yes, yes. All the important stuff. You know, because one of the things that a school is going to give you is stuff like that, but it's also going to give you structure and coursework and the idea of a demanding production schedule. And so there's that, which won't exist if you do like Lynda or FX PhD. It's not like a high pressure thing. So it can provide you information and not necessarily the experience of boiling alive. And so the the other thing that you can get from, let's say, a like when I went for computer animation at Ringling, you take computer animation where you learn every aspect of making a computer animated short. That includes being the person who wrote it and storyboarded it. That means the person who put together an animatic. That means the person who modeled it, who did the UVs. UVs are awful. Who did the rigging, who you know, did the animation, all of the different passes of animation, who did the lighting and then the compositing and editing to put it all together. So there is a lot you can learn from doing all of this stuff, and that can tell you eventually, like if you go work for a larger company where you have to specialize in a certain part of the pipeline, what part of that job you liked doing and what part of that job you did not like doing. You might have noticed me say that I hate UVing. That let me know that I was not going to be a modeler. As much as I enjoy modeling things and building really complex stuff, there's nothing I hate more in life than making UV maps.
Well, I think it's all PTEX these days, Joe.
Not really. But the, you know, that's the kind of thing where you can get exposure to that from also like a Lynda course or from whatever. Like you could just like pursue like all kinds of little things to figure out what it is you want to do. And like Dan is saying, especially with something like compositing skills, those are much easier to pick up and comply to a wider variety of things in just the general filmmaking process than, let's say the 3D aspects of it where you're making like models and animating things and doing particle effects or whatever. Like those are specific to other things. Also, if you're interested in games, then that is a different skill set than necessarily what you'd be pursuing if you're interested in films. There is some overlap between the two, but you are in essence working on making real-time stuff. So there aren't really lighting positions open for film. I mean, sorry, for games, because they usually have engineers and people laying out levels and stuff do that, and like people bake out light maps and stuff like that. But they don't have like people doing like artistic spotlight, you know, stuff and like setting up different like physically accurate tracing properties of materials, because you can't do any of that real time. It doesn't happen. So those are different things to think about, and. So, like we both said, please consider something else that makes you more money, and you'll
unless
find
you enjoy being poor.
Yes, poor, moving around a lot, not having any control over your own schedule. and before anyone asks, because I'm sure there's going to be a follow up question of, if you don't like it so much, why do you do it? You kind of when you have done this for so many years, you realize that A, you still need to pay off your student loans, and B, you have learned this skill set, and you cannot go learn another skill set because you used up your skill slot for that.
Yeah, these don't really translate very well to another industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, like you're saying, you can perhaps branch out into film editing or something like that, or you know, work on commercial editing, or you know, do something like that, and that can be a course. And I've seen many people do that. I've seen people who were doing look development tasks at Sony that have gone off to do Python programming at other companies, like web-based Python programming. So you know, it all depends on what speaks to you and what your interests are. But in a general sense of like, I want to make movies, I just very much caution against the investment in it.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it is worth mentioning, at least from my perspective, that if you are looking for a stable job doing things similar to the things that we do, a corporate media gig is certainly a way to do similar things make things that you're potentially not super proud of, because corporations tend to take all the fun out of everything. not that I'm speaking from experience, but that's about as secure as a job would get, a cubicle job where you kind of make videos for a large corporation.
What an intelligent observation that you made.
And on that note, thank you, Joe, for a wonderful year of podcasting and this delightful episode where we got to answer some fun questions.
Yes. Thank you, Dan, for likewise. And also, thank you most of all for, I think, what can easily be said to be the creative influence on the course of the edits for the shows, because you edit almost all of them, and you insert little fun little gems every now and then, and they're super enjoyable. So I hope the audience appreciates all of the hard work that you do.
Well, I don't have that much else going on right now. So.
Okay. Well, anyway, he's selling himself short. He does a lot of work on the show, and so it is very important to recognize it. And thank you very much for doing that basically for almost everything for a year. I think by the time of this episode, I will have done like 8% of the editing on the show. not by minutes, but just by episode numbers. So that is something that you've really done almost everything. So congratulations to you, Dan.
Thank you. I am a control freak, and to my own detriment from time to time. But yes, thank you for that. And of course, as always, thank you to our audience for sending in questions, for continuing to tune in, for bearing with our ramblings for an entire year now. We appreciate and love you all very much.
Yes. And so thanks again to Master Dez, David Fuchs, Aaron L.M. Goodwin, Rob Lewis, Carlos Franco, Scott Williams, Todd Dijendorf, Simon Yang, Matthew Wilson, Rai Amadon, Anjay, and B&B.
You skipped Jeffinitely, although I didn't know if you wanted to think of. And of course, we got a question from
that wasn't
Mr.
On purpose.
TM Trains.
Yes.
Mr. TM Trains asked us our origin story as well, but we got that like several times. But yes, thank you to all the great questions.
All the great questions. And hopefully the at least standard or expected answers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here's to another year. Are we buttoning it up for good?
Oh, I think we're closing up shop.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have the tax incentives to keep the show going.
Man.
Yeah. I'm moving this show to Louisiana, and we're going to resume there.
I thought you were going to say Relay FM.
Oh, I don't think they give us any tax incentives.